Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 25th, 2011. Happy Thanksgiving weekend, everyone. When it comes to airline ticket pricing, the sky's the limit, and apparently it's contagious.
Hotels, rental cars, freight.
Ticket sales for concerts and for baseball games.
Automotive, retail, consumer packaged goods, cruise lines.
Dynamic pricing is coming to a store near you. And marriage is all about being open and honest, right? Well, every rule has an exception.
Maybe it's a little bit lying because you're hiding it from him.
I don't think we lie to each other. We just don't actively tell each other.
Confessions of financial infidelity. Plus, in the midst of high unemployment, many Americans are pounding the pavement in running shoes.
You know, if you look at my situation on paper, it's not great. You know, I'm laid off. I live at home. But I just had these deep thoughts as I was running. I'm like, you can really do anything.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Happy Thanksgiving weekend, everyone. Hope your travels went smoothly, especially because in all likelihood you paid through the nose for those airline tickets. Anyone who's booked airfare knows the system is rigged against you. The airlines have computer algorithms that make it nearly impossible for you to pay the same as the guy next to you on the airplane. It's called dynamic pricing, and we've covered it here before. But here's the bad news as you enter this holiday season. Other industries are starting to use the same method to price their products. Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
By now, most airline passengers know that airlines change their prices constantly to try and squeeze as much money from travelers as possible. It's why you may have paid twice as much for your seat as the guy sitting next to you. This process is called dynamic pricing, and a few industries have been using it for years. But now?
Oh, it's a hugely expanding field.
Andy Boyd is a dynamic pricing pioneer. He wrote some of the earliest computer algorithms to make it possible for airlines to change prices online automatically. Bob Phillips is another pioneer, and he says as more of the economy moves online, this practice is spreading.
Hotels, rental cars, freight.
Ticket sales for concerts and for baseball games.
Automotive, retail, consumer packaged goods, cruise lines.
Phillips says when it's done right, dynamic pricing can boost profits at all sorts of businesses, like banks. Phillips, who's also a professor at Columbia University, has created a formula that mixes a consumer's credit score with his or her likelihood to shop around. Banks use that combo score to know whether to offer that consumer a competitive interest rate or a high one. So what does this mean to banks' bottom line?
No, I can't give you a ballpark. Let's say it can increase operating profit on the order of 7 to 12%.
And that's money coming out of consumers' pockets. Keep that in mind as I bring in Oren Etzioni, a computer science professor at the University of Washington. Etzioni was flying to his brother's wedding a decade ago when he asked the traveler sitting next to him how much he paid for his ticket. Turned out, that guy got a much better deal than Etzioni did.
And I was actually somewhat incensed. I said, wait a minute. Why should that be? And I started thinking about, can we use computer methods, algorithms, to figure out when's the right time to buy your ticket?
In other words, beat the dynamic pricing geniuses at their own game. Etzioni started collecting online price data from all the airlines. Then he created his own formula that could predict when the airlines would raise or lower their prices. His company was bought by Microsoft. And today, when you search for flights on Microsoft's Bing search engine, you'll see an arrow letting you know if the price of that ticket is likely to head up or down. Now, Etzioni wants to do it again. He and his partner, Mike Friggin, have launched Decide.com.
So our tagline is no regrets.
This time, they're predicting the prices of electronics, phones, cameras, laptops, and flat-screen TVs. When Mike came by my office, my wife and I were debating whether or not to buy a new television.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Well, let's check them out.
Okay.
I'm going to help you decide if you should buy or wait.
When we logged on to Decide.com, it showed me the lowest price available for the TV we were looking at anywhere in the country. It showed me a price history for the product and when the next model would come out. Decide recommended we buy it, and we did. But what makes the site different is that it offers its best guess at whether the prices of those TVs are going to go up or down. Prices for electronics tend to bounce around.
You can see drops of $100, $200 over the course of a couple of days.
Sometimes, though, computerized pricing goes haywire. Earlier this year, two computer pricing algorithms ran amok on Amazon. The algorithms eventually set the price of a classic textbook on fruit flies at more than $24 million. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
One of the few upsides of a down economy is that recessions tend to be incubators for new businesses. People lose their jobs and decide to become entrepreneurs. Well, Ann Patchett, the acclaimed author of Bel Canto, didn't lose her job, but she did decide to open her own business this year. She looked around Nashville, where she lives, and realized that its bookstore business had become nearly obsolete. So last week, she opened Parnassus Books. We spoke with her about it a few months ago when she was in L.A. to promote her latest novel, State of Wonder. She said she couldn't live in a city without a special place to buy books.
I have to get in there and start a bookstore. I looked into it. I realized I had no idea what I was doing. A friend of mine said, you're like a really good cook who thinks she should open a restaurant because she knows how to cook, and it's not the same thing.
A little more to it than that.
Yes. And then I met a terrific woman named Karen Hayes, who was a sales rep for Random House, and she was opening a bookstore. And so what I've done is partnered with her. And wow. I've thrown myself into this and this project, and I'm really excited about it. It's going to work.
What are you finding most surprising about that entrepreneurial effort?
I think that what's amazing to me is that we go and look at these properties that have no walls, and there is a toilet sitting sideways on the middle of the floor and no ceiling. And Karen looks around and says, you know, I think this place has great potential. Let's just leave now before a rat bites us. I have no vision. I want everything to be clean and perfect and neat. I sort of expect to go into a building and see the shelves already there.
But for a living, you make up things in your head. You bring things up out of whole cloth. So
you're exactly
right. So they should come naturally to you.
I should be able to do this. There is a real discrepancy between being the person who makes the product that's sold in the store and the person who makes the store that sells the product. But I keep thinking, if I was a watchmaker and all the jewelry stores in town went out of business, I'd have to open a jewelry store, right?
Right, right. Why do you think it's important for a community like Nashville and any community to have its own bookstore?
I think that it really is an important part of the fabric of the community. For one thing, we have to raise up readers. So you've got to have a store where you can take your children and let them play and look at books and go sneak off and look at a couple of books yourself. And I think it's a community center. People come together for book groups and for public readings. I don't think that it's something that needs to be 30,000 square feet anymore, mm-hmm. but I think 2,000 square feet, 4,000 square feet, that's something that the community can sustain and really needs. The outpouring of love and joy that we've had since we announced that we were going to do this bookstore has been overwhelming.
Mm. Presumably, the departures of the previous bookstores owed a lot to technology. And, you know, I have to say, I'm newly a convert to reading all my books on my iPad. I download them from Amazon. I'm not. Oh, I know. Oh, she's making a gun pointed at me. Yeah, I'm not your best friend, I suppose, anymore.
I'm with you up until you say I download all my books from Amazon, because yeah. I do think that there are other e-reader options where you're going to be able to go in and buy your electronic book in your local independent bookstore.
Hmm.
Number one, the thing that's most important to me is that people read. Yeah. And how people choose to read, I am glad that there are more and more options. There are a lot of people I know, my husband being the top on the list, who reads so much more now that they have e-readers.
I find the same thing.
Absolutely. I think that's great. But I think that there is still a place for a bricks and mortar bookstore selling books with paper. Not everybody is going to want to read in the same way. And the thing that a bookstore is going to offer that your e-reader is never going to give you is you're going to be able to say, I just read this book. I loved it so much. and recommend something like that. Mm. And I'm going to be there to do it, or Karen's going to be there to say, what you need to read is this, and put a book in your hands.
Well, if I had Ann Patchett making my book recommendations for me in person, I would be there.
Exactly. That's really what we're banking on.
Ann Patchett, her new book is called State of Wonder. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Here in Los Angeles, you can see evidence of the entrepreneurial spirit pretty much every day at lunch and dinner time. They're called food trucks. Grilled cheese, cupcakes, lobster rolls, and most famously, Korean barbecue in a taco. The Kogi barbecue food truck is generally credited with sparking the food truck explosion. Roy Choi is one of the founders, and oddly enough, the classic Jack Kerouac book, On the Road, played a big part of his career transition.
I came into this world a transient soul. You name it, I've been there. San Francisco, Denver, Detroit, New Orleans, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Mexico City. That's probably why Jack Kerouac's On the Road found me at two critical points in my life. Sal Paradise and Dean Moriarty felt so fresh and alive and real. I felt like I met them. In fact, I actually have. In my partner at Kogi, Mark, I found Dean. And through him, I rediscovered the city I grew up in, Los Angeles, and that ability to color outside the lines of tradition and standard operating procedures. I was Sal, and he first found me as Sal when I was the chef de cuisine at the Beverly Hilton. I was by no way the master of the dojo, but there I gave orders and I took orders. I paid attention to the details of your progress as a cook, to your stomach as a diner. Mark was the restaurant manager at the Beverly Hilton, but it wasn't until we both left that we connected as men and not colleagues. Mark encouraged me to meet more people, get to know people, what they did. He pushed me to think about cooking my own way and starting my own thing. In some ways, like Kerouac writes, I was beginning to get the bug like Dean. He was simply a youth tremendously excited with life, and though he was a con man, he was only conning because he wanted so much to live and to get involved with the people who would otherwise pay no attention to him. I ended up talking with more people in the span of 3 weeks than I had in 10 years. Everything was a million miles a second. There really wasn't even a space to think or even room to breathe. It was all instinctive impulse. Let's put Korean barbecue inside a taco, man. You can do it, Roy. And that was it. The keys were in my hand. All of a sudden, the idea of going out on my own made sense. It didn't seem impossible anymore. I could turn the key and be off into the night. 9 p.m., 12 a.m., 4 a.m., 6 a.m., asleep in the sunlight of day. These were the hours I saw at the beginning of Kogi.
Roy Choi is the co-founder and executive chef of Kogi Barbecue. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions this holiday weekend. And helping us out is our own Chris Farrell. Happy Thanksgiving, Chris.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you.
You still reveling in the leftovers?
You know, here's my theory about Thanksgiving. I think it's a fairly common theory. It's good, but the leftovers are great.
I agree. That turkey sandwich with cranberry is what I look forward to every Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Okay, you had me with the turkey sandwich. Let's put the cranberry aside and put a little gravy on there, okay?
Okay, fair enough. Well, you know, while we're on the topic of Thanksgiving, you know, everybody, I'm sure, went around tables on Thursday and talked about what they're thankful for. But let's do that here on the air. What are you thankful for this year?
You know what I'm thankful for? You think about what, there are more than 25 million Americans unemployed, you know, involuntarily working part-time, marginally attached to the workforce. We got the numbers out that over the decade, typical household income fell by 7%. First time we've seen that in at least half a century. So what I'm thankful for is all those people who reach into their pockets to give.
Mm.
Median income folks, people low income folks, you know, they reach into their pocket to give with all the demands to try and save more, pay down your debt, the value of your house falling. They still think it's important to give. And that's a pretty remarkable statement.
I think that is something that I would be thankful for as well, and we all should be, particularly in this season of giving.
All right, Des, so what are you thankful for?
You know, I'd have to say that I am thankful for the fact that despite all the predictions of doom and gloom that have come at various points in this year, in terms of the economy completely tanking and, the world economy blowing up, you know, the S&P crisis, we weathered that. The debt ceiling crisis, we weathered that. And I guess I'm thankful that we live in a world where we actually can get through things without completely losing our minds.
That's right. There's a lot of fear mongering out there, and
yes,
it's really easy to get wrapped up in it, isn't it? I mean, it's and sometimes it's overpowering, but I think what you're saying is extremely important. You got to take a step back.
Amen. All right, well, let's take a step back and hit the phones. Veronica is with us from Seattle, one of my favorite cities. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, Tess.
So we were just talking about some of the things that we're thankful for. What about you this Thanksgiving weekend?
I really have to agree with what Chris said about being thankful for people who give. I work in the arts, so giving is a big, big part of where my income comes from. So I'm really grateful for those people.
Which part of the arts are you in?
I work in theater. I'm a stage manager.
So you get to tell people where to hit their marks.
Sort of. I'm more like the one backstage who makes sure that they don't fall into open holes and that they know where they're going to be going.
That's always
well, that's
a plus.
Good thing. What are you working on now? Is there a particular play?
Yeah, we just opened Christmas Carol at ACT Theater in Seattle, so anyone in Seattle should come and see it.
Oh, wonderful. Well, what can we help you out with today?
Well, I have a question about not about my finances, but about my parents' finances.
Uh-huh.
They're both in their early 60s, and my mom has been unemployed for just over a year now. And when she became unemployed last year, they started drawing on their home equity line of credit to help supplement the income. But the last week, I got a call from her, and she said that they maxed out their home equity line of credit.
Oh.
And now they decided to stop paying their mortgage. So I moonlight when I'm not stage managing as a financial planner. And
you
so,
do?
Yeah, I do.
Ah, so you're a CFP?
Not yet. I'm getting the schooling for it, and I should be taking the test within the next year or so, which is kind of terrifying, but it's very exciting.
Oh,
too.
Good luck.
Oh, you'll
good
be
luck.
Great.
Oh, thank you. So my parents were kind of my first guinea pigs, where they taught me a lot about where, you know, I could call them and say, hey, what are the terms of your mortgage? Teach me about that. Or I could ask them about their, you know, so I think I breached a boundary that's not normally breached between a parent and child very quickly, just because they were so open and they wanted to help me learn. And so
wow.
I guess now.
Yeah, that's not something that is a very easy thing to do, I think, for anyone, to talk to their parents about their money.
Yeah, so I guess now what I want to know is, how do I talk to them about their finances without getting too involved, without getting too emotional about it? Because it's not like one of my clients who I can separate myself from and say, all right, well, that's your problem. Walk away. It's not going to affect me.
So do they feel like at this point that's their only option?
Yeah, because they've also applied for a refinance and they were denied.
Mm-hmm.
They've had literally last year dozens of people come through their house and no one has bought because they live in South Florida and it's such, there's so many houses on the market. No one is interested.
How far underwater are they?
I think they owe about $350,000 right now.
And the house, do you know what the house is worth?
I think it's at $180,000 now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Veronica, you mentioned that you've already had several conversations with them about money. So what is it about this particular aspect of their situation that makes it more difficult for you?
What confounds me so much is that they kind of don't have the basics down, too. Like, I sort of, you know, put my advisor hat on, and I was talking to my mom about, okay, well, how does this affect your income versus your expenses? And she said, well, I don't really know what all of our expenses are.
Mm.
And it kind of blew my mind because, you know, your parents are your role model for that kind of stuff, and this really basic stuff she wasn't doing. So I kind of had to treat her like my younger clients, who I have to say, you know, all right, we'll try writing down your expenses for a month, try creating a basic budget. And
right. Was she open to that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That's good.
Okay, so Veronica, I had a couple of thoughts. Keep it sort of low key be very open about your finances so that, you know, if you think about when we're sharing, you know, if it's a one-way street, it's always a little bit uncomfortable. But if both are sharing, that helps the relationship. You're not going to solve everything at once. But I think that is a way of building this conversation. You know, and then as they get older, you're also going to be more involved in their finances as, you know, mental faculties deteriorate or ill health starts coming in. I have one other thought, you know, on the theater salary. I'm not sure how realistic this is, but I'll just toss it out there. You know, hire for them and pay for a fee-only financial planner to look at their overall situation. Get a completely outside objective analysis. And then again, you have something to talk to them about. Of course, that doesn't tell you what to do, but it might give you sort of a common framework to have this conversation over a longer period of time.
Sounds like a great Christmas gift.
Amen.
It's a wonderful Christmas
gift.
I think it's a great one.
All right. So does that help you out?
That helped me very much. Thank you guys so much.
All right. Happy holidays.
Okay.
You too.
All right. Next we go to Diane, and she is in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Diane.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So what are you thankful for this holiday season?
Gosh, I'm really thankful to have a job to go to, considering I've got a couple of friends that have been long time unemployed.
I think that's something anyone who has a job at this very moment should take a moment and say thanks for that. Well, so we were just talking to Veronica about a situation with her parents, and I don't know if you have spent this holiday weekend with yours or not, but how are your folks doing?
Well, great. In fact, we had turkey at my house. My father is deceased, but our 85-year-old mother is still with us.
Wonderful.
Which is wonderful.
That's great.
And she recently moved into a retirement community this summer. And my sister and I are trying to help her with her finances.
Ah, so here we are again. And is this something that you had talked about with your mom previously or something new for you?
You know, she has always been a good planner, and my father was an excellent planner and really took care of her. She has long-term care policy, and although she's not really utilizing it, she hasn't gone into assisted living yet. So she has that, and she has enough income through his pension and Social Security to basically pay for her monthly expense.
Well, good for her. So she's
great.
Got you on a good start with her. And is she healthy?
You know, her health is pretty good. It is. She's having some problems with memory. We probably missed a lot of signs along the way. It's probably been a couple of years now that this has been happening. And when we finally realized that the bills and other financial documents were just stacking up in her study, when usually she was very, very organized and having a lot of difficulty with her tax return, we probably should have stepped in at least 18 months ago to 2 years ago. And so my sister, in agreement with my mom, became the durable power of attorney to help her.
Good.
Because she had funds pretty not all over the place, but in six different areas, and she really didn't know what she had. There was one in particular where there was a significant problem.
Chris, this is something that we've talked about on the program before, the fact that, you know, as we age, actually one of the signs that something may be going slightly wrong is with finances.
Yeah.
It's something for all of us to be aware of as our parents age.
Yeah.
And by the way, the real key is just what you were talking about. It's kind of missing the bills. That's kind of a good signal.
Right.
Yeah.
And that happened. Yeah. Two or three different companies.
Well, I'm sorry this is happening with your mom, but do you know how bad the situation is at this point? Have you been able to go through all that paperwork?
Well, I tell you, my sister's been wonderful, and she probably would be the better caller, but she teaches school, so God bless her with those little ones. But she actually took the financial documents to an advisor she works with, and there was one particular broker that we were told that he was excessively trading, or it could be called, I think, churning.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that's terrible.
She lost about $50,000, and my sister called up the brokerage, and the broker that was helping her kind of coached her on just what to say. And that brokerage firm called my sister back in about 3 weeks and said, well, it looks like, yes, we did not have authority to be making these trades. And so they settled.
Wow. They actually admitted their mistake.
Yes. I think they were really fearful of us getting an attorney.
Yeah.
And right now, everything's been liquidated and we don't know what to do. She's got this money and we're advised to put it into an annuity paying 3%. And we're just not sure, you know, that may or may not be the right thing to do.
All right. So are you looking for advice on what to do with that pool of money?
Yes, yes. And how much to remain liquid as well. And she also, her house is for sale. I'm sure that probably won't sell until, you know, 2012 sometime, I hope.
Okay, so Chris, what we're looking at here is an 85-year-old who is in a retirement home at the start of some memory problems and has a chunk of change.
Yeah.
And what do you do with that?
Well, I have a couple thoughts. I mean, first of all, I would get a second opinion. And this is not casting aspersions at all on the broker who's made the recommendation about the annuity, because 3% is about the right number to be using.
Okay.
But it's just like going to a doctor, because here's what's concerned me. She's got a pretty good income. She's got Social Security and a pension.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sense is I'd get government insurance behind everything, you know, FDIC insured online savings account or the credit union equivalent, some treasury bills, keeping it where you have it right now, just being really conservative with it. I know the rate of interest is, what should we say the rate of interest is, Tess? Zero?
Yeah, pretty
0.1?
Close. Yeah.
0.2.
But the thing is, the money will be safe and you can draw on it easily if she needs the money. Because the thing with an annuity is once you put into annuity, then it's tied up.
Yeah.
And to actually break that contract or to get access to that money, there are typically very severe penalties for that.
Okay.
So it's going to sit there probably in an account that's not making you a whole lot off of it.
But it's not making you
kind of not anything, but it's safe.
It's safe, yeah.
But good for you guys for taking over this situation and handling it. Because, again, you know, it's just something that nobody really wants to talk about. You know?
No, and there's no way to prepare. It's kind of it's very awkward, it's a challenge, and you want to keep her involved, but it has to be on a selected basis.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. But so good for you for taking care of that.
Well, thank you.
It does sound, though, like you have a good relationship, and boy, I had to tell you, that is probably the of anything, that's the key, because when there's not a good relationship, that's when it becomes so difficult. So.
Oh, I know. And I've heard so many stories and said, oh, we're very, very lucky. My sister and I have a good relationship. And then, of course, my mom is just a wonderful person, and we really do want to help her.
Well, good for you.
Great.
Happy holidays to all of you.
Well, you too. Thank you both so
much. All right. Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
And finally, we are talking once again to Nick here in Los Angeles, and we have talked with him before. Let's hear a little clip from that.
My wife and I have been saving for multiple years to take a six-month world trip, and while we would love to take this trip, you know, with a poor economy, is this just a foolish, conspicuous consumption?
All right. So, hi, Nick. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Was it foolish, conspicuous consumption?
No, actually, I think in the end, when you think about the things that are valuable in life, this had great value.
All right. Well, remind us what your question was.
Well, my question was, you know, I wanted to take 6 months off, and I wanted to just kind of get a sense of, you know, whether I was just shooting myself in the financial pocket.
Yeah. And what did we tell you to do?
Told me to go for it.
All right. I like it when we
can
do
good.
That.
Yes.
You know, I explained my situation. Chris talked about how I had already mitigated the risk as much as I possibly could. And luckily, it went really well.
Awesome. So where did you go?
Well, we went into a total of 17 countries.
Whoa. Where was your favorite place?
We get this question asked all the time. I'd say the country that from start to beginning was the nicest overall is probably Thailand. They had great food, great beaches. But I think my favorite singular experience would have occurred in India, where we got to see wild tigers roaming around eating a humongous deer.
Wow.
Only about 30 feet away from us.
Oh, my goodness.
So you didn't have that thought, boy, I wish I hadn't listened to those guys when the tigers are that close?
Not at that point.
Well, so, you know, I'm remembering, I think that one of the concerns was your wife and the fact that she was going to have to leave her job, I think, in order to do this. Did she find another job when you got back?
She's still searching. It takes a little time.
So how concerning is that to you for your finances?
It's a little concerning. Luckily, I make about 2/3 of our income, so we could, you know, just pare down our saving rate a little bit, but we could still, you know, live basically the same. And since we're not saving for a world trip, that's actually where most of her money would have gone anyway.
Right. So what's she doing to try to get herself out there?
One of the things that she's been trying to do is volunteer. She works in the environmental field. They oftentimes need help, but they don't have money, so they pay for volunteers. So she's mm-hmm. trying to do some of those just to keep her name out there and keep her skills up. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. This is a really great piece of advice and something we've mentioned on the program before. Volunteering is a super way to both keep your skills up and meet people who could connect
you
with other
people. And the other thing that it does is when she does go in for the interview with the employer, you know, it's a very easy conversation or it's on your resume. What have you been doing? And so it just makes it very easy as well. I've been volunteering here and doing that. But I think the main thing is it's that it allows for that networking. And most jobs, that's how they come about.
Yeah.
So, Nick, I forgot to ask you when we first got you on the phone. We've been asking everyone today what they're thankful for. You want to give us what you're thankful for this year?
I'm thankful for taking a long trip with my wife and coming out of it loving her more than I did coming in, if that was possible.
Oh, that's so
nice. That's really
nice. I love
that. Yeah.
Let's end on that, shall we?
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your advice.
All right. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send us an email with the Getting Personal link at our website. It is marketplace.org. Chris, very happy holidays to you. Gobble, gobble.
Happy holidays to you. I was trying to come up with something back to gobble, gobble, and you know what?
There is no comeback to gobble, gobble.
There is no comeback to that. Happy holidays.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. We've had Freakonomics, Emotionomics, and earlier this year we learned a new one, Spousonomics. It's the idea that every marriage should be treated like the business partnership that it is, behavioral finance for the bedroom and beyond. Paula Schumann and Jenny Anderson wrote the book on Spousonomics, and I first spoke with them about it back in February. So what made either of you think that the dismal science had anything to say about romance?
Well, isn't it obvious? Well, actually, it's called the dismal science, but technically economics is the study of the allocation of scarce resources, which we kind of find has incredibly apt parallels to marriage, because what are we doing if not trying to allocate time, money, patience, energy, libido? Okay.
Right. I was going to pipe in with that one.
Yeah. And, you know, it used to be easy to allocate it all when it was just one person, and then suddenly it's two people, and then maybe there's kids, and it's even more people, and it's a real challenge. So economics seems actually apt.
Well, all kinds of terms pop up in the book. Moral hazard, division of labor, and you have examples in the book of couples who basically keep bar graphs in their heads of who's doing what around the house and, you know, whether things are fair. I can't relate to that at all.
Right. Neither can we.
Neither can we.
Right, exactly.
I think everyone does some scorekeeping. That's the problem.
No, never, never. But you use this example of doing the dishes to illustrate an economic concept called comparative advantage, specialization. Tell us about the dishes.
The issue really is, what are you better at vis-a-vis the other chore? So it's just trying to divide up everything. So if I'm a little bit faster at doing the dishes, but a lot faster at doing the laundry, then I should definitely do the laundry and you should do the dishes. And you can change it up. And it's, you know, this isn't a recipe for you have to do the dishes for the rest of your life.
Right.
But when you sort of look at the tasks that need to be done, you need to sort of think a little bit more about who's better at what. And with those free hours, let's get back to the business of being romantic and being in love and having fun, because thank God the damn dishes are done.
Well, let's talk about that extra leisure time, because you spend an entire chapter talking about supply and demand, or how to have more sex. And I guess it's pretty easy to figure out where the supply and demand come from here, but you start the chapter with a bar graph.
Right. Well,
the negative sloping demand curve. You never thought about your sex life in those terms?
We just thought that would really grab people who wanted to know about sex as a nice bar graph.
Right. So tell us about the cost-benefit analysis here. You say that the key to more sex is lowering the cost of it, but we are not talking about what it sounds like we're talking about.
Right. We're not saying pay less. I mean, if you pay your spouse for sex, then that's your business and that's fine.
Right. But, and you need more than our book to help you, I think.
Yeah. Yes. Or maybe you have got it all figured out. I don't know.
The basis of the supply and demand is that lower costs and demand goes up. So the argument is, make it cheaper for yourself and make it easier for yourself. We talked to so many couples who said, you know, by the time I get home, we put the kids to bed, we make dinner, you know, we're on our Blackberries, have to go back, maybe answer a few more emails. You know, we get in bed, it's like, ugh, just want to watch Jon Stewart and go to bed. A lot of couples had found some really creative solutions for making it easier for themselves. One couple set a goal. They said, you know, we're going to have sex 3 times a week for the next whatever
Operation
it was.
Operation Hat Trick.
Yeah, Operation Hat Trick, which is, you know, 3 goals in ice hockey. And they did it. And what they found is they didn't have amazing sex. They had sort of mediocre sex, but they had a lot of it. And they would be the first people to tell you that a lot of mediocre sex is better than no amazing sex. And that seemed to be the goal. We're all waiting for sort of a big chunk of time so we can have amazing sex. And then expectations are high and you sort of have to think about it. And then people are more intimidated by it. Whereas if it's just, you know what, let's just cut out some time maybe before dinner when we're not so tired. Make it easier for yourself and maybe you'll have a little bit more sex.
Well, you are both relative newlyweds, so let me ask each of you, is there any problem or conflict in your marriage that economics has not been able to remedy? Jenny?
I think my husband would answer my tone of voice. I don't know that economics has been as effective as we would like it to be. I wrote a chapter on incentives, and clearly nagging and punishment and sort of making someone feel terrible is not a particularly productive incentive to get what you want. And yet I find myself at times not taking that to heart. I hope I'm a little bit better at it, but I'm sure he would concur that my tone of voice is not as spousonomical as he would like it to be.
Paula?
I would say this idea that we talk about in the book of not flooding your partner with information, I've tried and I'm better at it, but not completely great at when I get upset about something, not listing, you know, a bunch of other things that happen to be upsetting me at the same time or a bunch of other things he's done. As you can tell, I've kind of lost my voice and he was like, oh my God, this is like the fantasy life for me. You can't even speak. And I was like, enjoy it while it lasts, my friend, because in a couple days, I'm going to be back in action.
She's saving up.
Guys, it's been awfully fun. Loved the book. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Paula Schumann and Jenny Anderson are co-authors of the book Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. And now for a segment we'll call Talk to Marketplace Money and we'll make sure that by the end you want a divorce attorney. It's about financial infidelity, specifically spouses who hide purchases from each other. And before you judge people, bear in mind that a recent survey from an outfit called CESI Debt Solutions found 80% of married respondents said they do this. Now, you'd think no one in their right mind would want to talk on national radio about it. But you'd be wrong.
Okay, so this is our joint closet. However, my husband only comes on this side, and I come way back in here, so I do a lot of my hiding my stuff back here.
That is 40-year-old Mary Barnes of Redondo Beach, California. And she was taking us on a tour of hidden purchases in a medium-sized closet that she shares with 44-year-old Chris, her husband of 8 years. He works in the pharmaceutical industry. She teaches preschool. They have 2 kids. Mary is whispering a little because Chris is right downstairs.
But I was just at my favorite store. I haven't even pulled it out, but I have some stuff here.
And she had a shopping bag of workout clothes in one hand. And then Mary pulled out a box that seemed like it would be hard to miss in such a tight space.
Well, I got it before my husband got home. The clothes were up high, so he didn't see it. Honestly, I'm not really sure why this happens. I guess because things that I feel are important to me, he doesn't necessarily feel are important, and that we could spend that money somewhere else.
How much spending are we talking about here? About $300 worth. She received that money as a Christmas gift, but still felt compelled to hide the purchases she'd made with it. She says she feels judged and guilty. But surely Chris isn't totally unaware that this is happening, right?
I don't know if she actively hides them. It's more like they're hidden in plain sight. You know what I mean? And my purchases are too.
Wait, what? Yes, he hides purchases too. Music, mostly.
I don't think we lie to each other. We just don't actively tell each other. Don't ask, don't tell.
Yes, but that's been repealed.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. I got to get with the times.
Maybe it's a little bit lying because you're hiding it from him.
Actually, no, there isn't a distinction. Lying and withholding the truth. But I think intent here is very important.
That's Victoria Collins. She's a psychologist who specializes in money and relationships. And we asked her to help explain why people who love and trust each other enough to get married would keep such seemingly trivial secrets.
Part of the reason we don't want to tell our spouse about spending is that we don't want to feel like a child again.
In other words, we don't want a spouse questioning every dollar we spend or making judgments about what we buy. We're adults, right? Collins also says some of the shopping guilt is self-created based on what kind of spending culture we grew up with. And in fact, Mary had an epiphany about her spendthrift father, who just might also be a factor in her squirreling away of packages. So let's hear what happens when we bring Chris and Mary back together in their condo.
All right, well, we are all back upstairs. I suppose this would be my Oprah moment. So what I gather from my conversations with each of you separately is Mary feels guilty when she makes purchases that she thinks you might not approve of, so she hides them. And, you know, what we understand from you, Chris, is that you really wouldn't care.
So that's true.
Tell me what's going on here.
You really don't care?
Communication. I really don't, because I trust you enough to know you're going to make the right decisions.
I guess maybe sometimes the reason why I hide it is because I already have something similar. And then I'll buy something that's very similar. And
5 million jeans.
Okay, I hear some judgment in there.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
I don't know. That's a good point. This is a reckoning.
How can you not?
I don't think I do that. Because usually I'll notice something that's new and just not say anything.
Really? You, know, you do?
Yeah. Don't think I don't see the Lucy box in the closet when I come home to put my shoes.
Now, we realize that one couple does not a representative sample make. So here's another marriage for us to tear asunder, two blocks away.
Hello.
Hi, Mindy. Nice to meet you.
Mindy.
48-year-old Hollywood set designer Mindy Keith is another secret shopper.
So a lot of times, you know, I'll come in through the back and then I'll just throw it in my closet or it'll get hung up right away, you know.
For the most part, it's bags of clothes we're talking about, again. And why the sneaking around behind her husband's back?
He's never made any big deal about anything I've ever bought, but I almost feel bad just buying more stuff because he knows how much stuff I have.
She does have multiple closets full already, but says she does not need husband Ted's judgmental eye on those bags. And after 12 years of marriage?
I feel that if we both work, we're both entitled to buy whatever we want, as long as it doesn't put the family in a crisis. I don't feel like I have to tell my husband everything I buy.
And one thing we haven't mentioned yet, our couples both use the yours, mine, and ours approach to bank accounts. So they separate their money, yet still deal with issues of guilt and perceived disapproval. And according to Ted Keith, it is all perceived, not real.
She works hard. I don't want to give her grief over that. So I think she thinks that I'd be a lot madder than I am.
Our money psychologist, Victoria Collins, says there is a solution to all this financial infidelity. Just talk.
One of the things that might be helpful to couples like this is to schedule a financial date night. During this 1 hour period of time, each one can say anything they want, and there's no blame.
As we left Chris and Mary Barnes' house, I wondered if that might be a starting point for them.
So what are you going to talk about at the dinner table tonight?
Probably very uncomfortably quiet.
Funny how I don't remember them thanking us for coming. It's easy to get lost in numbers when you look at unemployment in this country. But really, it's about individuals who have to hold it together when the thing that they used to spend most of their waking hours doing is no longer there, and neither is the paycheck. Everyone has their own coping mechanism, but more and more Americans are turning to running in this stagnant economy. Today we have the story of one woman who's getting back on her feet by getting back on her feet.
She can start jogging.
When I lost my job in December, I did get more serious about running. I've had more time to devote to it, fortunately, and I'll be running my first full marathon this November in Philadelphia. My name is Laura Pizzuto, and most of my career I've worked in finance. I graduated college in 2003, and I basically just took the first job I could find. I knew someone that could get me a job at a mortgage company. I was a processor, I was a post-closer, a closer. I applied for other positions in the company, but unfortunately that wasn't possible. Our company had downsized, and then we were sold. running is something that I didn't have so much trouble succeeding at. My hard work paid off, which my hard work did not pay off at a lot of my jobs. You know, promotions, raises were not available. Running was. Running, I put a lot of hard work in, and then I became faster. Well, it's 5:30 at Sheila Dennis' house, and we already have some members waiting. Good morning, ladies! I wake up very early in the morning to go to a homeless shelter in North Philadelphia. It's called Sheila Dennis' house, and I volunteer for a program called Back on My Feet. I'm at every run. I'm greeting everybody. We do have a coach on the team, but if they're not there, I lead them through stretches. How many jumping jacks should we do today? Let's do 15. 1, 2, 3. I run with a large group of large personalities, and I've just really developed some great friendships with all of them. Our team captain is her name is Dawn.
My name is Dawn Estelle Garrett. I became homeless in October. I started running with Back on My Feet in December. My running joke is I run for the ice cream truck. The ice cream truck. What's the joke?
No, Dawn was not a runner.
I was 289 pounds at one point.
I'm not sure what Dawn weighs now.
170. I'm in shape now. I'm toned. I actually can run now.
Dawn ran her first 5K in Wilmington, Delaware.
I ran for 2 miles straight. Then I got weak. I wanted to give up.
It's a challenging course. Wilmington is pretty hilly.
And the finish line was all uphill. And I'm like, no way. And my teammates were cheering.
We ran the whole 5K around Dawn. And she talks about when she runs that, you know, she needs to hear the Rocky theme song.
The Eye of the Tiger, that song.
We started to sing it to her.
Dun, 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 dun. I'm like, all right, yeah. Dun, dun, dun. And I'm thinking of the music in my head, and I'm like, all right, I can do it, I can do it. And it was beautiful. I crossed the finish line, I had tears in my eyes. Because I normally start things, but I never finish them. Like jobs, I'll start a job and then I'll become dissatisfied with it and then I'll just be like, I'll move on to the next thing. I don't want to do that, you know? But I don't want to give up and be defeated. I'm just going to keep going forward. I want to complete some things in my life.
We're in the computer/guest room of my mother's house where I do my job searching. So their computer is a lot faster than my laptop. I'm looking mostly on idealist.org. I didn't care so much about those finance jobs. It wasn't a fulfilling career, and I really want to do something that I believe in. Okay, so this position is actually, okay, it's part-time case manager to victims of domestic violence. With every job, there's always something where, you know, I have to stretch a little bit. I do have a bachelor's degree. I'm not proficient in Spanish. I don't have prior case management experience. Some experience working in domestic violence issues. I haven't worked in them, but I do have a sensitivity to that. So this position, I think I can definitely give them a shot. I'll start working on my cover letter. Uncertainty is, it's a worry of mine. What if my mother loses her job again and I can't live here? And I have these thoughts, especially during my long runs. I had a half marathon 2 weeks ago. I had just an amazing, amazing run. I had a PR, personal record. I broke 2 hours by 6 seconds. And very dramatic. I have my medal here. You can hear it clanging. I feel really emotional. I just never thought that I would be able to do that, be able to run that fast. And I always say, you know, if you look at my situation on paper, it's not great. You know, I'm laid off. I live at home. It's okay. A finance person, they looked at me, my loan application, they would just reject. But I just feel so much more alive. And I just had these deep thoughts as I was running. I'm like, you can really do anything. You may not feel like that all the time, but if you really want something, you're making it happen. I mean, you're making it happen right now. You just feel unstoppable.
Marketplace's Gregory Warner produced our story. Last weekend, Laura finished the Philadelphia Marathon in 4 hours, 40 minutes, and 26 seconds. She's still job hunting, but meantime, she's also applying to graduate school to earn a master's degree in social work. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter @RadioTess. Next time, everyone loves a bargain, right? But is that discounted price really a deal at all?
Anytime a number pops into your mind, it influences your judgment. So you think a football player has made more tackles in a year if their jersey number is 97 than if it's 27.
We'll explain something called price anchoring and how it's influencing your buying decisions. Marketplace Money is produced by Devin Robbins with Stephen Hoffman. Our theme is composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.